Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and today we're going to do chapter 29 of The Unabridged, The International Jew by Henry Ford. And the selection that we're going to read will have been done in 1921 written. The whole series of occurred over about 91 weeks, 1920 and 1921. We've got our recordings of the first 28 chapters up at vnnforum.com, where we do all of our audiobooks. So let's get right to it. And like 28, this is more about Jew control of the theater. The title is The Rise of the First Jewish Theatrical Trust. It has long been known among dramatic critics that the reason for the maintenance of Ben-Hur in the theater for 19 years is this. It is the most successful of all the vehicles for pro-Semitism now on the stage. That will appear to be a prejudicial statement in the minds of the thousands who have seen and enjoyed Ben-Hur, but there is truth in it. The point which should not be overlooked, however, is that if Ben-Hur is useful in framing the public mind favorably toward the Jews, it is not because of a pro-Semitic intention in the story. That may be the intention of the producers, Messrs. Claw, with a K, and Erlanger, but it was not the intention of General Lew Wallace. It would seem that art and fate conspire against the propagandist play, for in no other way can the failure of avowedly pro-Semitic drama be explained. Perhaps there was never such a serious or even strenuous attempt made to force the Jewish-controlled theater into the service of pro-Semitism as has been made in recent months, and the attempts, with one possible exception, have been failures. Lavishly produced, heralded by an unbroken clack of press announcement, swathed in an initial chorus of praise, sponsored by officialdom which had been dragged out to stand godfather to the productions, they nevertheless have failed. Be it said to the credit of the American Jew that he has been one of the causes of the failure. A most significant and hopeful sign was the reaction of the intelligent Jewish community against the attempt to utilize the stage as a hustings to boost the Jew into an unreal eminence and desirability. And they evinced a spirit which, if it could be made to permeate all Jewish activities, would quickly dispose of the Jewish question under whatever phase it may be considered. It is this spirit of judging Jewish interest in the light of the whole which promises a helpful and lasting solution of all the differences which, unfortunately, have been permitted to arise between the people of Judah and others. The fact of Jewish control of the theater itself is not a grounds for complaint. If certain Jews, working separately or in groups, have succeeded in wrenching this rich business from its former Gentile control, that is a purely a matter of commercial interest. It is precisely on the same footing as if one group of Gentiles won the control from another group of Gentiles. It may be regarded as a business matter. In this, as in other business matters, however, there is the ethical test of how the control was gained and how it is used. Society is usually willing to receive the fact of control with equanimity, providing the control is not used for antisocial purposes. So we keep hearing this about industry after industry. It wouldn't matter if they didn't use their control to push through anti-white policies. And at this time, Jews had started coming into the country, as I've said, in massive numbers after 1880. And even though a law was passed against them a few years after this was written in 1924, Jews simply don't obey laws written by non-Jews. They don't respect non-Jews, so it then follows that they wouldn't respect their laws. They may argue against them, they may appear on the surface to accept the defeat and the rare times they were defeated, which is pretty much never nowadays, as they've done such things as boast they could get, you know, 90% of the Senate to sign off on some ADL statement on a napkin if they wanted in 20 minutes. But back then they still did not have complete power, and the tools that they would leverage to gain complete power did not quite exist. We had not quite fully entered the electronic age back in 1920. We didn't have TV. And the movies were still silent, if I got my timeline right, and radio was still developing. So they didn't have all the tools they would have to consolidate and centralize their control. So they took over what existed, the various industries, and one of them was theater. And we heard last chapter how they centralized booking and got rid of the old goy system where people worked on their craft out in the country and rose up to become stars by dint of being very good at acting. And they replaced that with the actor, with the talent, with the scenery and the production values, as they call them today, and lines of chorus girls, and instead of great actors. And they also revolutionized the booking system so that it was all centralized and handled by a Jewish firm out of New York who would just tell the Goy theater owners, before the Jews bought up all the theaters, in the flyover, or the provinces, as flyover was called back then, here's what you're going to get for the fall season of 1918, you know, something like, or for the season of 1918. Here are the acts we have. You know, typically they would be in New York, and they also talked about the star system, which is their way of simply promoting their own. Not that they were great actors, it was just whoever they were promoting. A star in New York, assumably, would be greater than anywhere else. And then they'd send these out after they did their run on Broadway or off-Broadway. They'd send them out to the provinces to make their appearance in Wichita and Cincinnati and Jacksonville and stuff like that. And so in response to that arose, what were they calling it, a little... little community, little theater or something like that, where Arian strove to put on the type of plays they wanted to see, sort of to recreate the old system for themselves in the smaller areas, smaller cities. But chapter 9, we're hearing about a different aspect of Jewish control. And he's saying there was definitely a movement to create pro-Semitic plays and foist them in the public. But maybe it was like what they said, satire is what closes Saturday night. It opens and closes. The people don't like satire. They like stuff that shows faithful. They don't like ripping sarcasm as much as they like faith-based religious stuff, because they're not on the level where they can appreciate something that's more intelligent. Similar to that, when they put out pro-Semitic stuff, there's no audience for it. And the only play that they could, which is was not inherently pro-Semitic is what he's saying, but they could twist to... a pro-Semitic turn was Ben-Hur, which I think, I'm not sure I've seen that, but that was later a movie with Charlton Heston, and they I think that was a Jewish slave resisting Rome. It was the theme of that. And so he's talking about Jews took over theater, and that fact in itself is not a grounds for complaint. It's the way that they've used their control that is the grounds for complaint. He says, society is usually willing to receive the fact of control with equanimity, providing the control is not used for anti-social purposes. We'd say anti-white in 2015. The fact that old-time Gentile producing managers usually died poor, Augustin Daly being about the only exception, while Jewish producing managers wax immensely wealthy, there being on this side the exception of the late Charles Frohman, would indicate that the Gentile managers were better artists and poorer businessmen than the Jewish managers. At least poorer businessmen, perhaps, and in any case, working on a system whose chief object was to produce plays, not profits. The advent of Jewish control put the theater on a more commercialized basis than it had previously known. It really represented applying the trust idea to the theater before it had been largely applied to industry. As early as the year 1896, the Theatrical Trust controlled 37 theaters in strategic cities. The men composing this alliance were Claw and Erlanger, Nixon and Zimmerman, and Heyman and Frohman. All but Zimmerman were Jews, and his racial origin was a subject of dispute. This group was later joined by Rich and Harris of Boston and Joseph Brooks, all known as Jews. Controlling these theaters, the trust was able to assure a long season to both managers and playing companies. Outside the trust, the managers and companies were left to make arrangements between each other, which resembled a species of barnstorming. You got to remember, parallel here to the movie industry, where Goy, like Edison, invent the technology, and Jews seize upon it and create Nickelodeon, nickel shows. That's what Nickelodeon originally meant. You put in your nickel and you watch a little show of some girl dancing around. And typically they went immediately to ribald fare, not to say overt pornography. And then they took some of their stolen technology and moved out to Hollywood and created the movie industry. And here in the theater, you already have theaters established around the country, and they're buying it up and trying to form, as he's saying, a trust. so that they can control, essentially, just the way they would with TV, they can control what is seen in the theater in all the major cities. The effect on the independent theaters and managers was disastrous. The trust boosted royalties on plays from $50 to $450 and eventually to $1,000 a week. This of itself cut off the material of the stock companies with which the independent managers endeavor to keep open their houses. The running out of the stock companies by excessive charges for the use of plays that had already been used in the regular theaters of the trust really served Jewish interests in another way. The motion picture industry was coming to the front. It was a Jewish enterprise from the first. There never was any need to drive Gentiles out of that, because the Gentiles never had a chance to get in, even though they created the technology. Thus, the driving out of the stock companies threw the empty theaters over to the movies, and the benefit was again confined to that particular racial group. This will answer the question so frequently asked by people who wonder why the theaters they formerly saw offering plays at all seasons are not devoting the larger part of the year to movies. Are now devoting the larger part of the year to movies. And also, when you have a movie, you pay to produce the movie, and then you simply show the movie. You don't have to continue paying actors and actresses and such. It was not to be expected that this sort of thing could be put through without a struggle. There was a struggle, and a severe one, but it has ended with what the public can see today. The opposition offered by the artists was prolonged and dignified. Francis Wilson, Nat C. Goodwin, James A. Hearn, James O'Neill, Richard Mansfield, Mrs. Fisk, and James K. Hackett stood out for a time, all of them with the exception of Goodwin, bound by a forfeit of $1,000 if they deserted the cause of a free theater. Joseph Jefferson was always with the actors in this opposition and continued of the same mind to the end, playing in both trust and antitrust houses. It is a matter of record that Nat Goodwin was the first to give in. He was the head and front of the opposition, but he had his weaknesses, which were well known to the trust and upon which they played. One of his weaknesses was for New York engagements, and he was offered a long engagement at the Knickerbocker Theater. He was also given the promise of dates wherever and whenever he wanted them. Goodwin thereupon deserted the Alliance of Stars and became the henchman of the trust. The trust was the name by which the new control was known in these days. The racial name was not given, although the racial nature was plainly discerned. Nat Goodwin's star began to decline from that day. He made a final essay as Shylock, and with that he was practically ushered out as a headliner of the serious stage. Richard Mansfield and Francis Wilson were delivering nightly curtain speeches against the trust wherever they appeared, and although the public was sympathetic, it was very much like the present state of affairs. What could the public do? What can an unorganized public ever do against a small, organized, determined minority? Same thing as that's like, what can whites ever do against Jews so long as they aren't organized? The public, or whites, hardly ever appear as a party in any of the movements that concern themselves. The public is the prize for which the party strive, right, to mulk the white population, to milk it. The trust dealt strongly with Wilson. His dates were canceled. Neither his status nor his ability was of any avail to him. One of the trust made an open statement. Mr. Wilson is a shining mark, and we determined to make an example of him for the benefit of the lesser offenders. Wilson's strong spirit was finally subdued to see reason. In 1898, the Philadelphia members of the trust offered him $50,000 for his business, and he took it. In due time, Richard Mansfield also surrendered, and Mrs. Fisk was left alone to carry on the fight. The theatrical trust, which must be described as Jewish because it was that, was at the beginning of the new century in full control of the field. So, again, he was saying that in the last segment, he said that it was 1885 was the year that really marked the Jewish entry into the American stage, and by 1900, they totally controlled the theaters. How about that? The theatrical trust must be described as Jewish because it was, at the beginning of the new century, was in full control of the field. It had reduced what was essentially an art to a time clock cash register system, working with the mechanical precision of a well-managed factory. It suppressed individuality and initiative, killed off competition, drove out the Independent manager and star, excluded all but foreign playwrights of established reputation, fostered the popularity of inferior talent, which was predominantly Jewish, sought to debase the service of the dramatic critics of the public press, foisted countless stars of mushroom growth upon a helpless public while driving real stars into obscurity. It handled plays, theaters, and actors like factory products, and began a process of vulgarizing and commercializing everything connected with the theater. And in the press, he's talked about Jews trivializing and demoralizing the public mind, and it's similar here, vulgarizing and commercializing what used to be an art. If space permitted, a number of opinions could be presented here from men like William Dean Howells, Norman Hapgood, and Thomas Bailey Aldrich, whose concern was for the theater, but who voiced no other observation as to the racial influences at work. Their concern was justified. It is quite possible that many who read this article are not interested in the theater, and are, in fact, convinced that the theater is a menace. Very well. What principally makes it a menace? This, that the stage today represents the principal cultural element of 50% of the people. What the average young person absorbs, so theater was the TV of the time, what the average young... The stage today represents the principal cultural element of 50% of the people. What the average young person absorbs as to good form, proper deportment, refinement, as contrasted with coarseness, correctness of speech or choice of words, customs and feelings of other nations, even fashions of clothes, as well as ideas of religion and law, are derived from what he sees and hears at the theater. The masses' sole idea of the homes and the life of the rich is derived from the stage and movies. More wrong notions are given, more prejudices created by the Jewish-controlled theater in 1 week than can be charged against a serious study of the Jewish question in a century. People sometimes wonder where the ideas of the younger generation come from. This is the answer. As we just said, all the original opposers of this new control of the theater surrendered and left Mrs. Fiske to fight alone. She had, however, an ally in her husband, Harrison Gray Fiske, who was the editor of the New York Dramatic Mirror. Mrs. Fiske herself had said, "The incompetent men who have seized upon the affairs of the stage in this country have all but killed art, ambition, and decency." Her husband wrote in his paper, "What then should be expected of a band of adventurers of an infamous origin, of no breeding, and utterly without artistic taste?" Let it be kept in mind that the ruling number of these men who compose the theatrical trust are absolutely unfit to serve in any but the most subordinate places in the economy of the stage, and that they ought not to be tolerated even in these places, except under a disciplined, active, vigorous, and uncompromising management. Their records are disreputable and in some cases criminal, and their methods are in keeping with their records. That was first printed in the Dramatic Mirror, December 25th, 1897, reprinted March 19th, 1898. This attack was regarded, foolishly and wrongfully, of course, as an attack on the whole House of Israel, and, as is always the case when one Jew is censored for wrongdoing, all the Jews in the U.S. came to the rescue. Pressure was brought to bear in a famous news company which handled the circulation of the most important magazines in the U.S., leading hotels were induced to withdraw the Dramatic Mirror from their newsstands. Mirror correspondents were refused admittance to theaters controlled by the trust. Any number of underground influences were set in operation to get Fiske and his business. Suit was brought against Fiske for $10,000 damages for the strictures he had printed upon the personal character of certain members of the trust. Fiske replied in his answer, setting up various facts against specific members of the trust, their records, actions, and so on. One he accused of carrying on business under a fictitious name, or a cover name, as it is known in Jewish circles. Another he accused of charging managers for advertising expenses that were never incurred. Another he accused of issuing complimentary tickets in which he did a private speculative business of his own, selling them and pocketing the proceeds. It's called ICE. Another he accused of specific crime for which he had been arrested and convicted. He charged that the trust as a whole advertised in various cities that, quote, the original New York company would play, charging exorbitant admission fees on the strength of this advertisement, when in truth these were secondary companies and not the one advertised. A strange court hearing was held in which the magistrate did not wish to hear any of Fisk's testimony, even forbidding him to enter official records of the criminal proceedings had against a certain member of the trust. The magistrate did not seem to want to hear what Fisk based his statements upon. There was a serious shooting scrape involving a woman, but the magistrate did not want to hear about it. There was even considerable difficulty on the part of Fisk's lawyer in procuring the attendance of Abraham L. Erlanger at court, although he was one of the complainants. All the important questions asked of Claw were overruled. As to Al Heyman, the court overruled all questions relating to his real name and the circumstances under which he left Australia. The facts were not brought out in this hearing, but the whole character of the hearing was made known to the public. Fisk was bound over to the grand jury with $300 bail and every allegation of libel. The grand jury lost no time in dismissing all the complaints against Fisk. The trust members had come off badly because of their evident unwillingness to meet the case. They were revealed to be a much lower type of men than the American public had supposed was in charge of the American theater. They were shown to be a type that would not even stop at demanding the discharge of a local newspaper reporter whose critique of their plays did not please them. The fight of the dramatic critics against the bribery, and then against the bludgeoning of the theatrical trust, makes a story of which echoes have frequently come to the American public through the press. Conciliatory at first, with managers, actors, playwrights, and critics, the trust, as soon as it gained power, showed the claws beneath the velvet. It had the millions of dollars of the public coming its way. Why should it care? Whenever a critic opposed its methods or pointed out the inferior, coarse, and degrading character of the trust productions, he was ordered barred from the trust theaters, and local managers were instructed to demand his discharge from the newspaper. It is with mingled feelings that an American is compelled to relate that in many, many cases the demand was complied with, the papers being threatened with the loss of Sunday advertising. But here and there, courageous writers on the stage held to the honor of their profession and refused to be bribed or intimidated. Writers like James S. Metcalf of Life, Hilary Bell of the New York Press, Frederick F. Schrader of the Washington Post, Norman Hapgood on the New York Evening Globe. Remember, there were a lot more newspapers back then than there are today. There'd be like five or six in a town like New York, plus ethnic ones in different languages, not just one per town as we see today, 100 years later. James O'Donnell Bennett of the Chicago Record Herald. These men stood against the trust and made their fight. Metcalf went so far as to bring a suit against the trust for unlawful exclusion from a place of public amusement. The courts were kind to the trust. They decided that a theater may pick its patrons. Even in very recent years, the trust has followed blacklisted dramatic critics in an effort to prevent their employment by newspapers. The theatrical trust does not exist in the form it did 10 years ago. It grew arrogant and bred secret enemies among its own people. A new force arose, but it was also Jewish, as it originated in the Schubert brothers with David Belasco. Instead of one, the Americans now have a dual dictatorship of the stage. The rage of the day is not plays, but playhouses. With not three plays of any character to distinguish them from the dregs of the stage, they are now building in New York alone a dozen new playhouses. The theatrical business has entered upon its real estate phase. There is money in renting chairs at the rate of $1 to $3 an hour. The renting of the chairs is a reality. The stage is rapidly becoming an illusion. And that ends chapter 29 about the creation of a theatrical trust that lowered moral and artistic standards, destroyed American artists, and essentially destroyed stage criticism. So Jews operate very much as a blight, where they appear, civilization withers, is probably the best verb. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.